Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. I hope it's nice where you are.
I hope so, too. And even if it's raining, that can be nice, too. We've had some lovely, dreary, cold weather this week in Iowa.
And yes, we have, but at least it wasn't snow.
And it is March, it's to be expected.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So, yeah, but our book today is about something, it has a topic that is a lot worse than the weather.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, and it's something that's just, this book is a page-turner. There's no doubt about it, because it is. You're right there. You're right there in the moment, and that's the beauty of this book. And it was an important time. Our author today is the author of Ground Zero, and it's his name is Alan Krantz, and he is the New York Times best-selling author of several highly acclaimed books for young readers, including Allies, Grenade, Project 1065, Prisoner B-3087, and Code of Honor. This novel, Refugee, is often referred to as a modern classic and has remained a New York Times bestseller list for over 2 years. I mean, that's really an accomplishment. Alan lives in North Carolina with his wife and daughter. And this book, Ground Zero, is really something. It really is.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Alan. Would you pronounce your name for us so we get it correctly?
Oh, sure. Caroline was right on it. It's Alan Grant. Grant's like rat.
I'm sure that could have caused some problems when you were a middle schooler.
just a little bit. But I survived middle school. Thank you guys for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. It's a rainy, dreary day here in Asheville, North Carolina as well.
So why did you become a writer of fiction for middle schoolers?
Yeah, you know, I knew that I wanted to be a writer since I was a young boy, and I really didn't know what form that would take. I didn't know if I would be writing books or comic books or plays or movies or TV shows, or I didn't know what, but I knew I wanted to be a writer. And then as I went through school and I studied creative writing at the University of Tennessee, I still experimented with a lot of different genres. And even as an adult out of school, I was trying different things and throwing them against the wall to see if they would stick. And then I guess it was around the time that my wife was the book and toy buyer for a group of independent bookstores. And she was the children's book and toy buyer, I should say. And she was coming home with galleys of new books that were coming out. This was around the time that Speak by Laurie Hulse Anderson came out. The Golden Compass had just come out by Philip Pullman. And she was like, read this. These are amazing. And I read the books and they were amazing. And I thought, this is what I want to do. Like, I love all the other things I've been trying to write, but these books, like middle grade and young adult fiction, is really amazing right now. And I wanted to be a part of that. And so I set everything else aside and said, I'm going to just set out to be a writer for young readers. And, a little while after that, I became an eighth grade English teacher myself. And so I was using young adult and middle grade books in the classroom. And it just really seemed like a natural fit. And I got my first book published. It was a young adult novel, Samurai Shortstop, and I've never looked back.
And, of course, not only young people read your books or any young
right,
adult
no,
books.
It, yeah. Right. And this has been a really, really fantastic thing, is that even though I write books for young readers, I have a lot of adult readers. And a lot of times it'll be an adult reader who's been brought to my books by a young reader in their life. You know, a child or a student will come to them saying, you've got to read this book. And then they're excited that the young person in their life is excited about books. And so they read it. I think a lot of times they pick it up just to kind of humor their, their child or their student say, oh, sure, I'll read the book with you. And then, but then I get an email a little while later saying, wow, like, you knocked my socks off with this book. And I really appreciate that too. I do have readers young and old, young and older.
I think ever since Harry Potter, it's become cool to read young adult books as an adult.
I agree. Yeah. I think that really opened the door. The YA renaissance that we've had here in the last few decades, couple of decades, has really been one that's been fueled by first teenage readers, and then as they grew up, they continued to read young adult fiction. And I was an adult when the Harry Potter books came out and loved those and read those. So I agree with you. I think that era surrounding the Harry Potter books really made it fashionable, made it okay for people to read kids' books and realize that they're not just the juvenile fiction of 40 years ago.
And of course, if you go back 40 years or longer, there were books, young adult books then that also were popular among adults. And I'm thinking The Outsiders,
sure,
things like that. So it's not entirely a new phenomenon. A Wrinkle in Time. Going even further back, I think it's always been the case, but maybe the adult readers of young adult books have just come out of the closet a little more.
I think so. And really, the Harry Potter books were the first kind of appointment reading for young adult and middle grade books. Previous to that, I know this because my wife worked in bookstores and sales for so long. Before the Harry Potter books, young adult and middle grade fiction would be put on the bookshelf and given a year and a half to sell. And if in that time the book did not sell, then finally the bookstore would return the book to the publisher. Once the Harry Potter books came out and people were lining up at midnight to buy a brand new children's book, right? Then there was a much less patience for turnover on the shelves if a book didn't sell within the first 6 months or 3 months, a bookstore might say, we're going to return that book now. We've also had, at the same time, a flood of new books. We have so many children's books being published every year, whereas back in the days of Madeline L'Engle and S.E. Hinton, there were fewer. We certainly had those books and we had readers, but there wasn't the sheer volume of books being published that we have today. And so I think all those things combined to turn children's books into a really commercial endeavor. And now they get promoted more. They get talked about more. Like you said, the readers have come out of the closet, and now I think the readers of kids' books are legion.
I think you're right. I think you're right. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline today, and our guest is Alan Gratz, author of Ground Zero. I think most people probably know from the title what this book is about. It is a novel of 9/11. So that's almost 20 years ago. Why write this book now, 20 years on?
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you say that a lot of people will recognize what the book is by the title. I have young readers who are on Zoom events with me where I'm introducing this book. It just came out a couple of months ago, and I introduced the book to them. And one of the questions a lot of kids ask me is, why is it called Ground Zero? And this is an answer to your larger question, which is, why write this book now? My daughter, as an example, is 18 years old. She is a freshman in college this year, and she was born in 2002. She was born a year after 9/11. If you are a kid in elementary school, in middle school, in high school right now, even into college, you weren't alive when 9/11 happened. And maybe for the kids who were just a little bit older than that, maybe you were in kindergarten or first grade or second grade and really didn't understand the gravity of the situation when it happened. And so we as adults, when you hear the words Ground Zero, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But many kids do not. They know about 9/11. They're it's not unheard of to them, but it's often not taught in schools. And a lot of adults don't want to talk about 9/11 I think for a variety of reasons, but chief among them that it was so painful for so many of us that we don't want to talk about it. And I was getting requests from kids who had read my other books and knew I wrote about tough topics. And they kept saying, please write a book about 9/11, write a book about 9/11. And I kept thinking, oh, I don't know if I can do that emotionally, if I'm ready to go back and face all the things that happened and dive into that in a research way. But I realized that so many kids really don't know much about what happened that day. And they're eager to learn. They want to know more. And so, I realized, as you pointed out, this year is the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. It will be in September.
Yeah.
And, I thought, if I'm ever going to do this, why not on this anniversary? It feels like it happened just yesterday in some ways and a million years ago in other ways. And finally decided to tackle it this year because of the anniversary and because I realized there are a lot of kids out there who want to know more and don't know much about 9/11.
How did you go about researching this? I mean,
sure.
What was available to you?
Yeah. So first of all, there are two different storylines in this book, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more. But I tell the story of that day of September 11th, 2001, from the point of view of a boy named Brandon, who's 9 years old and is in the North Tower when the first plane hits and has to try and survive. And I also tell the story from the point of view in the present day of an 11-year-old girl named Reshmina, who lives in Afghanistan and is caught in her own version of 9/11 in the present day as her village becomes a battleground between the United States and the Taliban. And to do the research for this book, then I had to do two different rounds of research. The first was to research 9/11. And yes, I was an adult in the United States when this happened. And yes, like most other Americans, I was glued to my television and reading the newspaper and reading everything, learning everything I could about what happened in the moment, in those days and weeks and months that followed 9/11. But I still, even as I dove into the research for the 9/11 side, realized there was so much I didn't know. I had not read more about the experiences of people inside the towers, partially out of just, I didn't know if I could take it back then, and I mm-hmm. didn't want to know just how horrible it really was. But for this book, I had to really dive into that research. I had to really read about what it was like in the Twin Towers that day for people who survived and for people who did not. So there have been, because it's 20 years ago and because it was such a monumental event in U.S. history, there have been a lot of books and magazine articles written about 9/11. And so I had a wealth of resources for that side of the story, but I still had to do like research that goes beyond the casual layperson's reading about an event. I writing about the Twin Towers, for example, I had to know what the layout of those buildings was. How many elevators? There were 99 elevators in each of the buildings. And I needed to know, you're right, I needed to know where they were and how they operated. I needed to know where the stairwells were. There were 99 elevators, but only 3 stairwells. And this, of course, famously is one of the reasons that many people did not get out of the Twin Towers in time. And I needed to know where those were and what floors were affected by the plane immediately as it struck. And then what floors were people trapped on and couldn't get out. I needed to know, part of my story takes place in the mall underneath the Twin Towers. What was the layout of the mall like? What were the shops in that mall? And the reason I didn't want to just make assumptions about layouts or make assumptions about stores in the mall or stairwells is because the Twin Towers, they estimated that about 40,000 people went through the Twin Towers every day, every single day. And like these places were part of the geography of the lives of so many people. And if I were to get any part of that wrong, then it would immediately pull all of those people who were familiar with that place out of the story. Mm-hmm. And I needed to make sure that all of that was as accurate as I could get 20 years later. For Reshmina's story, I had another particular challenge. That is about the war in Afghanistan, and that again has been going on for 20 years, and so there has been a lot written about that. But I also had to know more about what's going on in Afghanistan right now, or at least in 2019 when that part of the story is set. And for that, I was doing a lot of reading and watching documentaries. But the best angle that I had on that was, you mentioned at the outside, at the outset, Monica, one of my books is Refugee. And because I've written a book about refugees and been helping to raise money for UNICEF and talking up UNICEF, who work with refugees around the world, I was able, through UNICEF contacts, to talk to the UNICEF team on the ground in Afghanistan right now, or at least when I was writing the book.
Oh, wow.
And they were able to tell me all about what life is like for children in Afghanistan in the present day, which is one of it switches out every year with Syria as the most dangerous country to live in the world. And so I got a really interesting insight into that world through that connection. But most of the time, my research is done in a library. That's my number one place I go and read lots and lots of books.
Like an old-fashioned library with actual books?
With actual books in it, yes. Where you and before the pandemic, I was actually able to walk in and talk to librarians. That's been a particular challenge in the last year for me as a historical fiction writer. I can't go in. I can't walk in the library anymore. My local library has just reopened to 50% capacity and for picking up books. And so that was a particular challenge for me in my new project.
Wow. And so you weren't even able to get books from the library, like curbside pickup?
For this one, I did.
Okay.
No, for this one, I did. For Ground Zero, I did, because this was I did the research writing of this pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
But for the new projects I'm working on, no, I've had to, I actually have ordered a lot of the books rather than be able to check them out through interlibrary loan, just because that resource wasn't available to me.
Wow. You know, I want to confirm what you said about kids not necessarily knowing much about Ground Zero, and in fact, sometimes not even being aware of 9/11 at all. I have two grandchildren who last spring, when the pandemic was starting, so they would have been 7 and 10 at that point, and I was talking to them about how it seems like in every generation there's some pivotal event that life is before and after, and it changes the world in some significant way. And I was saying, you know, for my generation, it probably was the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Right.
And in my kids' generation, it might have been the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, there was some world event that happened. And so I said, you know, for your generation, this pandemic is it. And I said, and it's, mm-hmm. but, and, you know, they were fearful about it. And so I was saying, you know, but life does go on and things do get back to normal. And so I was saying, think of 9/11. And the older one had heard of it. The younger one did not know anything about it. For them, the way that the world changes because of 9/11 is just the way the world is. And they don't know the before. And so I started talking about it, and I went to show them the video of it. And then I was, should I have done that? Because it was a little terrifying for them, even, you know, this many years afterwards, that had happened here in the United States. So I think it is.
It's a frightening thing.
Yeah, but I think it is good for kids to know. And I think this book, Ground Zero, is a good way for them to learn about it.
Oh, you too. Exactly.
Thanks. Yeah, I've heard other stories that are similar to that, where, for example, a young person playing with blocks, I mean, like a kindergartner or a first grader playing with blocks in a classroom and having a toy plane and then running into the stack of blocks and saying, oh, it's 9/11, and not even understanding, like all they know is a plane hit a building. Like that may be the depth of knowledge that a young person has about 9/11. They don't know where it happened or when it happened or why. And like you said, the biggest thing, of course, for us is what life was like before 9/11 and what life was like after 9/11. And those huge moments in time when there seems to be a before and an after. And when I was first talking about this book with my editor, Amy Friedman at Scholastic, she's an amazing editor and has worked with me on all of my Scholastic books. We were talking about me writing about 9/11. And in our very first conversation, before I ever knew what the story was or even begun to do research on it, I told her, I said, I could just write a book about that day, about 9/11. But the message at the end of that day was, Muslim terrorists are coming to kill us. And that day they were. But that hasn't been the message in the 20 years since then, or that hasn't been the most important thing. Look at today. We have so many other more pressing issues that are facing us as a country today. Racism, pandemics. We've got, you know, white supremacists and domestic terrorism are more a threat than foreign terrorists even. We have so many things that are, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter movement is far more important than Muslim terrorists are coming to kill us. And so we have all of these things that are facing us as a country today. And I said, I know it's important to write this book and I want to write this book, but I can't leave off with this message at the end that like goes back to something that's really outdated and 20 years old. And I said, for that, I have to write something that's another part of the story that's more contemporary, where I can at least show some effect of 9/11. And there were many things I could have done, especially if I'd set the other side of the story here in the United States. But ultimately, I chose the war in Afghanistan because we went to war there a month after 9/11. It was October of 2001, and we are still at war in Afghanistan. It is now officially the longest war in U.S. history. And unless something changes this October, we will reach the 20-year anniversary of that war, just like we will have just passed the 20-year anniversary of 9/11.
And I think a lot of people kind of forget that that's still happening, that that's still going on. We don't hear about it on the news.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
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 Wow. Yeah, we call the Korean War, America's forgotten war. And I often call the war in Afghanistan America's ignored war. And there are reasons for that. It's 20 years old. It's not news anymore. That we have significantly fewer soldiers in Afghanistan than we did at the height of the war, which was probably around 2010. It's also a war that's fought from the air by helicopters and drones and through proxy soldiers. Our Afghan allies whom we've trained, they have taken significantly more casualties than the United States soldiers have. And again, I think that there's a reason that we don't want to look at it in many ways, the same way that we don't want to think about the Vietnam War anymore. I think a lot of us can look at what's going on in Afghanistan and say, why did we really go in here and why are we still there? And yes, we've made great strides for Afghanistan. By taking the Taliban out of power, we stopped that brutal regime, and we've helped build more hospitals and more roads and schools, and there are fantastic opportunities for women and girls in Afghanistan that weren't there before. But there are still people dying in Afghanistan, still civilians dying. If we stay, it'll be bad, and if we leave, it'll be bad. And I wanted to get at that in Ground Zero, and I pose for both of my characters impossible decisions where no matter what they decide to do, someone will still be hurt. And to me, that's kind of the Afghanistan war in a nutshell.
Now, Alan, a lot of your books seem to be set in war times. I'm looking at your webpage, alangratz.com, and you've got, looks like a World War II book, a couple of World War II books,
of those.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what other wars have you written about?
So I've written mostly about World War II, but I've also written books about terrorism. I've written a book that focuses on the Holocaust in World War II, but I've done the European theater, and I've also done the Pacific theater in World War II. So, yes, I have ended up writing about war a lot, and it really began with with Prisoner B3087. Prisoner was my first book for Scholastic, and it is based on the true story of a man named Jack Gruner, who as a boy survived 10 different Nazi concentration camps during World War II. Jack was a real person. He's passed away now. He died about 3 years ago. But I got to meet him and sit down with him, and he told me his story, and then I wrote it up as a novel in Prisoner B3087, and I thought it was done with war. I thought it was done writing about World War II in particular. And then I started getting fan mail from kids. The number one thing that all the kids said was, when are you going to write more books about World War II? It's like, okay, hey, hang on, let me finish this book I'm working on, and I promise I'll get back to it. When a lot of kids write to you and say, we want more books about something, you write it. A lot of my books since then have been about World War II. Refugee has a World War II angle on refugees leaving Nazi Germany in 1939. And then after that came Grenade, which is a story of the Battle of Okinawa, and Allies, which is a story of D-Day. So Ground Zero, not about World War II, but of course about a war, this one, the Afghanistan War.
I wanted to ask you, why do you think we aren't treating the what's called the immigration crisis as a refugee crisis? Because to me, that's what it really is.
Yeah, I agree with you. Right now, the immigration issues that we're having at our southern border are largely caused by refugees who are leaving because of who are essentially climate or some of them are climate refugees. They're no longer able to survive in the places that they lived in Central America. Some of them are refugees because of the violence that has broken out because of the lack of resources in those areas. But yes, it is a refugee situation. And I think that we don't treat it like a refugee situation, because then we'd actually have to let a lot of them in. And I think there are a lot of people in the United States who don't want immigrants and refugees in the country. And I think that when you look at them as refugees, which they really are, then it becomes a moral question. How can you turn someone away who needs help? If it's a question of, these people are just coming here because they want better opportunities, and they're going to take our jobs, and they're going to live on our welfare, then it's easy for people to say, well, I don't want that. But when you say, these are people, if they go home, they're going to die. If we turn them away and they go back to where they came from, they will die of hunger, or they will die of thirst, or they will die because a gang killed them or murdered them in the street. When you put it like that, it makes it harder to say no. And I think that people look for reasons to say no. And I think that when we see it as a humanitarian crisis, we would let more people in. But if we don't, then it makes it easier to just say no.
I agree. And, you know, it's the same as before World War II, when we turned away, the United States turned away Jewish refugees. And we look back at that and think, we were wrong. We should not have done that. That was wrong. That was immoral. And I think 50 years from now, people are going to be looking back at what we're doing now and say, how could they have been that way? How could they have done that?
I think so, too. And I often, when I speak to kids about refugees and about immigrants, I point out to them, unless you are Native American or your family were brought here as slaves, then every one of you that I'm talking to, your family at some point chose to come from wherever they lived in the world to this country. They chose to come to the United States. And maybe they came here as refugees. Maybe they were a religious refugee who were being persecuted somewhere. Or maybe they also were escaping a famine in Ireland, for example, and came to this country. But we look back at all the people who make this country great, and all the places they've come from. You know, St. Patrick's Day was yesterday. We have an enormous Irish American population who are a backbone of this country, German immigrants. We have lots of immigrants from Eastern Europe and from Asia, all over the world. And these are the people who make America great. But for some reason, we want to close that door now. For some reason, we want to say, well, the new people who come in won't make us great. We made this country great, but they're going to ruin it. I don't understand that at all, because every new group that has come to this country has made it better, made it richer. And I don't want to get too political, but we have senators whose parents came to this country as immigrants and made a life for their child who's now a senator. And now that senator wants to say no more.
I know who you're talking about.
And I'm like, why did you get to do it and nobody else gets to do it? I don't understand. Like, what is this feeling that so many of us have that, like, if we've been here, you know, if we're already here, we deserve it. And if you're not here, you don't. It's so strange to me. I think we're the greatest country in the world. I really do. And I think we could be doing so much more to be a leader and to show the world what it means to be the greatest country in the world.
I spent some time 2 years ago on Lesbos, which is a Greek island off the coast of Turkey that sort of bears a large part of the brunt of the Syrian and Middle Eastern and Afghanistan refugee crisis. And I met some refugees, worked in a camp for a little, did an art project with a friend who does that with the refugee camps there. And, you know, such wonderful, wonderful people. And so they're living such a difficult life. And since then, that camp was, had a major fire in this past year. And it's horrible. And we look at that and think, well, why isn't Europe doing more? Why are they're just these people coming. I mean, I went to the beach where the people come ashore and met one of the men who would take their boats out every day and rescue people, pull people out of the sea. And the cafe that I ate at had turned into a triage center, you know, the table where they were trying to save lives. Most people here in the States just aren't aware of that at all. And if they are, they may feel sympathy for those people and think they should be doing more, but they're ignoring what's happening at our own southern border.
Yeah.
I wish I had the answers.
No, me too. And that's the other thing is I write these books really not because I have all the answers. I don't have any answers. I write the books more to do what you're talking about, to shine a light on the situation. And I'm basically saying, look, what I can do is I can write books. And if I can use that skill to bring more attention to this crisis, then I will do it. And then you reader, whether you're a young person or an adult, when you see what's happening, what I've written about, what skills can you bring to bear to make this situation better? What is it that you can do? You know, I try to raise money for groups like UNICEF, and I donate money. I write stories that shine a light on these situations. And I do presentations with kids every month. Before the pandemic, I was visiting up to 100 schools a year talking about these things. And, you know, I'm doing what I can to raise awareness of the situation. Because I think what you're getting at is exactly it, that a lot of us, whether by choice or by convenience, we don't see these things. I visited El Paso right before the pandemic began and met with people who lived in El Paso, and I was talking to them about the border. And they live with this every day. They cross back and forth to visit family every day. And this is a real live issue for them. They're when they drive to work, I was told that there's an interstate that runs right along the border on the U.S. side. And as they drive to work, some of the teachers were telling me in the morning, they will have to be wary in the dark of people running across the interstate who've just come through the border like through a culvert or over a wall and are running across the interstate, and they have to watch out not to hit these people. Like, and there are refugee camps in El Paso and just outside of it. They are people who are living, they are Americans living with this issue. And I think a lot of us, because we don't live with it on a daily basis, we cannot see it if we don't want to.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Alan Gratz, author of Ground Zero, a novel of 9/11. Alan, would you like to read from Ground Zero for us?
I'd love to. So I chose two passages for you. Since I have two characters, I thought I would split time between the two characters.
That makes sense.
Yeah, right. So the first is Brandon, as I introduced earlier. He's 9 years old. He has gotten into trouble at school. He got into a fight protecting a friend from a bully, and now he's been suspended. And so he has to go into work with his dad, who happens to work at Windows on the World, the restaurant at the very top of the North Tower of the World Trade Center up on the 107th floor. And he has a plan to fix things, starting with getting down to the mall in the basement and buying a replacement toy that's been broken in this misadventure at school. And he is, in this passage that I'm about to read, just sneaking out of the restaurant to go down to the mall and getting in the elevator. So if you're ready, I will go for it.
We are.
All right, let's do it. So this is Brandon sneaking out of the window, out of Windows on the World, and trying to get to the elevators. Brandon hurried past Miss Ng, who was still reassuring the diners, and over to the elevators. He pressed the down button and looked over his shoulder nervously, hoping his dad wouldn't come out of the kitchen and see him. Ding! An elevator door opened. It wasn't the express elevator that went straight back down to the lobby. This one only went to the sky lobby on the 78th floor. From there, Brandon would have to take two more elevators to get downstairs. It wouldn't be as fast, but Brandon didn't want to wait around for someone to spot him. Brandon jumped onto the elevator, just missing the closing doors. He'd made it. Brandon leaned against the railing at the back of the elevator and smiled. He couldn't fix punching Stuart Pendleton in the nose, but he could fix breaking Cedric's Wolverine gloves, and that made him feel better. The elevator slowed to a stop, and an elderly white man with silver hair got on. The elevator stopped again, and a blonde white woman in a purple pantsuit got on, followed by a big white guy in a blue blazer and a red necktie. I shouldn't have taken the local, Brandon thought. He glanced at his Lego watch, 8:45 a.m. He was going to have to be speedy if he didn't want his dad to find out he was gone. The elevator stopped again, and a man with brown skin and a graying beard wheeled a catering cart with empty dishes onto the elevator. He wore a light blue turban that matched the color of his Windows on the World uniform. Brandon froze. The man wore a name tag that said Chavender. Brandon didn't recognize him, but he worried Chavender might have seen Brandon around the restaurant and would know he was Leo Chavez's son. Brandon slipped farther behind the big white guy and watched the red digital numbers of the floors tick by. 94, 93, 92, 91, 90, 89, 88, 87, 86, boom. Something boomed above them, and the elevator suddenly went sideways. Brandon grabbed onto the handrail to not fall over. Two other passengers, the blonde woman and the old man, did fall down, but Brandon couldn't have helped them even if he'd tried. The elevator was shuddering so wildly, it felt like someone had taken him by the shoulders and was shaking the life out of him. And then a new sensation. They were falling. No, the elevator car wasn't falling. It was leaning farther and farther and farther to the side, like they were on the tilt-a-whirl at Coney Island. Brandon held tight onto the handrail, digging in his heels, while the other passengers slid forward until they were all pinned to the opposite wall. The serving cart toppled over, spilling dishes and water and silverware. Brandon's mind raced, trying to make sense of what was happening. The elevator couldn't swing this far in the elevator shaft. Elevator shafts were just a little bit bigger than the elevators inside them. That meant the whole tower was leaning, all 107 floors. That wasn't possible, was it? The elevator stopped tilting, and Brandon held his breath. No one uttered a word. Then slowly, sickeningly, popping and complaining the whole way, the elevator began to right itself. It came up straight, and Brandon caught his breath. But then the elevator swayed in the other direction. The passengers who'd been pinned to the wall scrambled to cling to the railing to stay put. Brandon closed his eyes and braced himself as silverware and broken plates came skittering across the floor toward him. But the elevator didn't swing so far this time. It shuddered and groaned its way back upright. The lights flickered, but stayed on. And suddenly everything was quiet again. "What the hell?" the silver-haired man started to say. And then the elevator began to slide.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Yeah, that, right. See, that was the scary thing, because when you're in an elevator, you think you're safe. You know, you never think.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and the last thing you want is for that elevator to be doing anything it's not programmed to do. I mean, that's right. The scary thing is when you know that's not the way an elevator works. Right. I read so many accounts of people who, there were 99 elevators, as I said, in each of the buildings. And so there were a lot of people in elevators when those planes hit. And when the planes hit, especially in the North Tower, the elevator shafts went all the way up and down the towers, and the elevators might work in different blocks within those shafts, but the shafts went from top to bottom. The explosion was channeled out the sides of the buildings, but also down through the elevator shafts. And so many of the elevators were hit by flames and fire. In fact, the rotating doors, the elevator doors at the bottom of the elevator shaft that came out in the mall in the basement blew off when the planes hit, because of the force of the explosion 90 floors up.
Wow.
So it was, if you were in an elevator, it was a dangerous situation, but there were people who got out of the elevators and survived. And so I wanted to make that part of this story.
Okay, so now let's move to Afghanistan.
Right. So now we'll move to Afghanistan. And Reshmina is, again, my main character here. She's 11 years old. And her village has just become a battleground between the United States and the Taliban, as I mentioned earlier. The United States, some soldiers were called to the village. And it was a ruse so that as they were leaving, they would be attacked in a sneak attack by the Taliban. This battle has happened. She and her family, Reshmina and her family, have huddled inside their house, and they have waited out the gunfire and the helicopters and the explosions. And now that it is all cleared, it's back to life as normal. Just because your village was a battleground doesn't mean that you you get a day off from collecting the firewood and preparing the meals and doing the laundry. So it's just part of life in Afghanistan. And so the battle is over, and Reshmina is now back at her chores. She is being sent out to go and collect firewood. When Moore was gone, Moore is her mother. When Moore was gone, Reshmina picked up her English notebook and tucked it under her tunic before ducking out the back door to go collect firewood. As she made her way around the mountain, she read her English lessons out loud. Palwasha uses a computer to write an email. She talks to her friends on Facebook. Reshmina had never used a computer, but she knew what one looked like. Some of the older girls at school practiced for when they would finally get a computer by tapping letters drawn on a piece of cardboard and reading books about the Windows operating system. Reshmina didn't know what Facebook was, but apparently it was very important. Reshmina picked up a dry twig. "There is a party on the beach," she read aloud from her notebook. "Palwasha drives her mother to the party in her car." Someone groaned. Reshmina froze and looked around for the source of the sound. A few meters away, lying on his stomach among dried leaves and dirt, was an American soldier. His face was charred like a scorched pot, and there were dark, wet spots on his uniform. Blood, Reshmina realized. he must have been injured in the battle. The soldier groaned again and dragged himself forward. Where was he going? He twisted his head this way and that, as though he was looking for something. But there were only scrub trees as far as Reshmina could see. The soldier's head turned toward Reshmina, and she held her breath. But his eyes swept past her like he hadn't even seen her. He's lost his eyesight, Reshmina realized. The black marks on his face, he'd been wounded and couldn't see. If someone didn't help him, he would die out here in these woods. Or the Taliban would find him, and his death would be far more painful. Reshmina frowned. Why should she care? The Americans had killed her sister, after all. Pashtun Wali, the way of the Pashtun people, said that it was right and just to seek revenge against someone who had done you wrong. In Pashto, that revenge was called Badal, and it never ran out. Reshmina could wait 12 years, 1,000, and still take her revenge on someone who had wronged her. Why not just slip away then and let this man die? Reshmina flipped her notebook shut to leave, but she fumbled it. Her notebook hit the ground with a flump, and the soldier's head turned in her direction again. Is someone there? He asked in English. Hello? I can't see. My ears are ringing. I'm hurt. Hello? Can you help me, please? Reshmina silently cursed her clumsiness. If she had been able to slip away without him hearing, she could have left the soldier to die and been done with it. But now he had heard her, and he had specifically asked for her help. Just as Pashtun Wali gave her the right to revenge, it also said that when a person asked for help or protection, no Pashtun could refuse, no matter who was asking, friend or foe. That was Nana Matai, what the Americans would call refuge. Reshmina sagged. She could still slip away and have her revenge, but now it would mean denying aid to someone who had asked for it. Hello? The American soldier asked again, his voice weak. Please, he begged. Whoever you are, will you help me?
And that was Alan Gratz reading from Ground Zero. Alan, how did you learn about those religious principles?
All books. more books. One of the things that I do when I am writing about another culture and another people is, besides learning about the events that have formed their lives, the current events, if you will, or the events in the past that dictated their lives, I also want to learn as much as I can about how they would live out without those things happening. What kinds of music do they listen to? What are their religious beliefs? What do they eat for breakfast and lunch and dinner? Do they eat 3 meals a day or do they eat differently? What kind of clothes do they wear? These are just a few of the many questions that I have to ask about a culture that's not my own. And it is an enormous task. I will never, ever know everything there is to know about the Afghan people or the Pashtuns or about Okinawans when I wrote about the Battle of Okinawa, or the French when I wrote about D-Day and the French resistance. I will never be an insider. I will never be from one of those communities. So the best I can do is do my due diligence. I have to read and learn as much as I can, talk to people from those communities and those cultures as well, and try to not only represent who they are and how they live, but how they think. That's a huge thing that is, I think, the biggest thing to overcome. I cannot, if I'm going to write about a girl in Afghanistan in the present day, I cannot write from an American perspective. I absolutely cannot. I have to think about her. What has her life been like? How has she been raised? How does she see the United States? How does she see her life in Afghanistan and her family and the other people in her world? It has to be different than the way I see the world. It has to be. So I have to do my best to put myself in the shoes of, in a body of somebody else and see the world through their eyes.
Wow. Are all of the people in Afghanistan Pashtun?
No. So the Pashtun people are a people who live on the eastern side of Afghanistan, really, and they cross over the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in fact, they lived in a large area there in the mountains and in the lowlands right around the mountains. And then post-World War II, to get back to World War II again, when national borders were being redrawn after the war ended, famously a British ornithologist who'd been put in charge of redrawing the borders of countries drew the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan right through the middle of Pashtun country without even knowing that this was, of course, dividing a people. Many people say that there ought to be another country called Pashtunistan or something to that effect, that would be this group of people who do identify as Afghan, but also some of them identify as Pakistani. And but they are a group that for whom the border means nothing. This is their territory, and we the West drew a border right through the middle of it. So they are the people who live in the mountains of southeastern Afghanistan, and they are very different than the people who live in other parts of Afghanistan. So that was another thing that I had to do, was not just learn about, I couldn't just say she's Afghan. I had to actually find what tribe she'd be from and where she lived, and that changed even what her primary language would be. She speaks Pashto rather than speaking Farsi as her primary language.
Was that division of the Pashtuns part of kind of the root of the problems in Afghanistan with the Taliban?
To a certain degree, but really that the whole business with the Taliban was really, it goes back farther than that, and it's a lot of it is due to outside influences. One of the things I talk about in Ground Zero is how often Afghanistan has been invaded. I mean, you go all the way back to Alexander the Great invaded Afghanistan, and then the Mongols, and then later on other Arab countries invaded Afghanistan, and then you had the British who invaded in all the Crimean War business and the wars in Afghanistan for them. And then you had decades later, the Soviets invaded and fought a war that many people point to as one of the things that finally brought down the Soviet Union, was one of the many factors that led to the end of the Soviet Union. And so then when the Soviets left, there was a power vacuum. I'm getting back up to the Taliban now. And there was a power vacuum, and Afghanistan was riddled with civil war. There were many warlords who tried to take control of their particular areas or their particular towns. And one group of Saudi-trained and educated scholars came back to their home country of Afghanistan. Taliban actually means, I think, student. They were students who came back and said, enough of all this infighting. We're going to take over and create one way, and we're all going to do this, and we're going to base it in this very fundamentalist, very extreme interpretation of Islam. And they were able to gain power and wrestle control from all the individual warlords who were fighting in Afghanistan to rule Afghanistan overall. That said, they still had internal conflict before the United States invaded. There were certain towns and certain warlords who were holdouts, especially in the north. And they were still trying to subdue those groups. But then when 9/11 happened, I should back up for a minute. Before 9/11, this was a country where Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda used as a headquarters because of the chaos, and the Taliban were sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. And so they let them build a headquarters in Afghanistan and train soldiers, train terrorists in Afghanistan, so that when 9/11 happened and we the United States were looking for Osama bin Laden, we realized intelligence told us that he was training people in Afghanistan. And we went to Afghanistan and the Taliban, and we said, let us in, so that we can go and hunt this man down? And they said no. And that's when we decided, well, if you're not with us, you're against us. Famously, we told the world, and we invaded Afghanistan a month after 9/11 because the Taliban would not let us in. We had turned a blind eye to all the awful things they were doing before because it didn't matter to us. And now, as soon as it mattered, we were all about toppling the Taliban and coming in to do that. So, no, as a matter of fact, a lot of the Pashtun, I'm sorry, a lot of the Taliban come from the Pashtun people just because they are, they're outsiders. They were people who would stick to the mountains and learn to fight and survive in the mountains, traditionally, all the way from Alexander the Great up. Everybody is able to roll through and conquer Kabul, including the United States. But when you get to those mountains and the Pashtun people, that's when every army is turned back.
I bet there's 1,000 stories to be told.
Indeed.
The reason I enjoyed this book is, I mean, it's a lot of detail in it, but you are there, the reader is there minute by minute. And that's why you can learn so much from this, because you're in it. And I would like to read some more of your books to see if you probably have the same approach to all of your writing.
Yes. And the thing about writing for young people as my primary audience, and I'll get back to this before we're done, is that young readers, they have a lot of things competing for their attention. They have video games, they have their phones, they have television, they have friends, they have playing outside. And I love all those things. I wouldn't want to get rid of any of those things. And that all those things were, except for phones, a huge part of my childhood. And my feeling is that I have to write a book that competes with all those things, that is as good as all of those other things, to keep my kids reading. And so I try to write books that are action-packed, that the story gets going right from the start. Those two passages I read from you are in the first 30 pages of this book, where the action gets going very quickly. It has young characters that you care for and that you root for, and that the pace never lets up. You know, no kid has ever gotten through 100 pages of a book and said, well, nothing's really happening, but it got a good review in the New York Times Book Review, so I think I'll give it another 100 pages. Right? So, instead, if a kid gets through one page, five pages, if I even get them to the end of my first chapter and nothing has happened, they're going to put that book down and they're going to go do one of the dozen other things that are vying for their attention. And so my job is to write a book they can't put down, and I hope that translates to adult readers as well.
Well, I think it does.
It did to me. Yeah. I can guarantee that.
So, Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Oh, I do. This actually came from the. I like to quote from the book when I can. This was something that Chris Brandon and we didn't touch on this, but there was a young man who helped Brandon through all that. His name was Richard, and so he and Brandon got through this and. Brandon, or Richard, and both Brandon and Richard say, Brandon realized something. It isn't me against the world. It's everyone working together, and not against the world either, but for each other. That was how we survived.
Wow. That's a great quote. And Alan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you both. It was fantastic to talk to you.
It was our pleasure. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye now.